said Guinevere. And Kevin smiled and said,
"Perhaps the harp is the one instrument which cannot sound evil, no matter how badly played. I wonder if that is why it is dedicated to the gods."
Guinevere's lips tightened. Must he spoil the delight of this hour by speaking of his infernal gods?
The man was, after all, a misshapen toad. Without his music, he would never be allowed to sit at any respectable board. Somewhere she had heard that he was no more than a peasant's foundling brat. She wouldn't offend him when he had come to give them pleasure. But she looked away. Let Elaine chatter with him, if she would. She stood up and went to the door.
"It is as hot in here as the breath of hell," she said irritably, and flung it open. Across the sky, darkening now, flamed spears of light darting out of the north. Her cry brought Elaine and the serving woman, and even Kevin, folding his harp tenderly into its covering, dragged himself heavily to the door.
"Oh, what is it? What does it portend?" she cried.
Kevin said quietly,
"The Northmen say it is the flashing of spears in the country of the giants. When it is seen on earth, it portends a great battle. And sure enough, that is what we face now. A battle where Arthur's legion, madam, may determine, with the help of all the gods, whether we live as civilized men or go into the darkness forever. You should have gone to Camelot, Lady Guinevere. It is not right that the High King should be concerned now with women and babes."
She turned on him and flared.
"What would you know of women or babes, or of battles, Druid?"
"Why, this would not be my first battle, my queen," he said equably. "My lady was from a king who gifted me for playing his war harps to his victory. Would you think I should have gone to safety with the maidens and the skirted eunuchs of the Christian priests? Not I, madam. Not even Taliesin, old as he is, will run from battle."
Silence, and above them the northern lights flamed and flared.
"By your leave, my queen, I must go to my Lord Arthur, and speak with him and the Lord Merlin of what these lights portend for the battle which comes upon us."
Guinevere felt it like a sharp knife run through her belly. Even this malformed heathen might be with Arthur now. Yet she, his wife, must lurk here out of sight, although she bore the hope of his kingdom. She had thought, if ever she bore Arthur's son, then he must give her place and show her great respect, not treat her still as that useless woman he had been forced to take as part of a dowry of horses. Yet here she was, packed off into a corner again, because he could not be rid of her, and even her gallant banner thrust back at her unwanted. Kevin said with swift concern,
"Are you ill, my queen? Lady Elaine, assist her."
He held out a hand to Guinevere, but it was misshapen, a twisted wrist,
and she saw the serpent coiling around it, tattooed there in blue. And she recoiled sharply and struck out at him, hardly knowing what she did,
so that Kevin, who was none too steady on his feet, lost his balance and fell heavily to the stone floor. "Keep away from me," she cried out, gasping. "Don't touch me with your evil serpents. Pagan, hell-bound, lay not your foul serpents on my babe."
"Guinevere!"
Elaine hurried to her. But instead of supporting Guinevere, she bent solicitously over Kevin and gave him her hand to rise. "Lord Druid, do not curse her. She is ill and she does not know what she does."
"Oh, do I not?"
Guinevere shrieked. "Do you think I do not know how you all look at me? Like a fool, as if I were deaf and dumb and blind. And you would calm me with kind words while you go behind the back of the priests to claim Arthur for pagan wickedness and heathendom. You who would give us over to the hands of the evil sorcerers. Go from here, lest my babe be deformed because I have looked on your vile face."
Kevin shut his eyes, and the twisted hands clamped.
But he turned quietly away and began laboriously hoisting his harp over his shoulder. He fumbled for his stick. Elaine handed it to him, and Guinevere heard her whisper, "Forgive her, Lord Druid. She is ill and knows not." Kevin's musical voice was harsh.
"I know that well, lady. Think you I have never heard such sweet words from women before this?"
"I am sorry. I wished only to give you pleasure," he said. And Guinevere, her head hidden in her hands, heard the dragging hitch of his stick and his stumbling feet as he hauled himself painfully from the room. But even when he had gone, she went on huddling with her arms over her head. Ah, he had cursed her with those vile serpents. She could feel them stabbing and biting into her body. The spears of the flaring lights overhead were impaling her, the lights flaring in her brain. She screamed and hid her face with her hands and fell, writhing, as the spears went through her. She came to herself a little as she heard Elaine cry out, "Guinevere, cousin, look at me, speak to me. Oh, may the Holy Virgin help us. Send for the midwife. Look, the blood." "Kevin," Guinevere screamed, "Kevin has cursed my child." And she drew herself up frantically, pain lashing through her, beating with her fists against the stone wall. "Oh, God, help me. Send for the priest. The priest. Perhaps he can take away this curse." And ignoring the gushing of water and blood that now she could feel drenching her thighs, she dragged herself to the banner she had woven, signing herself with the cross again and again in a frenzy, before it all vanished in darkness and nightmare. It was days later that she understood she had been dangerously ill, that she had come near to bleeding to death when she miscarried the 4 months' child, which was too small and weak to breathe. "Arthur, now for certain he must hate me. I could not even bring his son to birth. Kevin, it was Kevin who cursed me with his serpents." She wandered in evil dreams of serpents and spears. And once, when Arthur came to her side and tried to hold her head, she started away in terror from the serpents which seemed to writhe on his wrists. Even when she was out of danger, she didn't recover her strength, but lay in a dreary apathy, unmoving, tears sliding down her face. She hadn't even the strength to wipe them away. No, it was folly to think Kevin had cursed her. That must have been a madness of her delirium. This wasn't the first child she had miscarried. And if there was any fault, it was her own, for staying here where she could not have fresh air and fresh food and exercise, and the company of her ladies. Her house priest came to her, and he too agreed that it was madness to think that Kevin had cursed her. God would not use the hands of a pagan priest to chastise her. "You must not be so quick to assign blame to others," he said severely. "If there is fault, it must be your own. Is there any unconfessed sin on your conscience, Lady Guinevere?"
"Unconfessed? No. For long ago she had confessed her love for Lancelot and had been absolved, and she had tried to keep her thoughts only on her lawful lord. No, it couldn't be that. And yet she had failed. I could not persuade. I was not strong enough to persuade Arthur to lay aside his pagan serpents and the Pendragon banner," she said weakly. "Would God punish my child for that?"
"Only you know what lies on your conscience, lady. And speak not of punishment for the child. He is in the bosom of Christ. But it is you and Arthur being punished, if there is punishment, which," he added primly, "I must not presume to say."
What can I do to atone? What can I do that God may send Arthur a son for Britain?
Have you truly done all you may to assure that Britain shall have a Christian king? Or do you hold back the words you know you must speak, because you wish to please your husband? The priest asked austerely. And when he had gone away, she lay looking at the banner. Every night now, she knew, the northern lights burned in the sky, in portent of the great battle that was to come. Yet once a Roman emperor had seen the sign of the cross in the sky, and the fate of all Britain had been changed. Could she but bring such a sign to Arthur? "Come, help me get up," she said to her woman. "I must finish the banner for Arthur to carry into battle." Arthur came that night to her chambers, just as she set the last stitches to it, and the women were lighting the lamps. "How is it with you now, my dear one? I'm glad to see you up again and well enough to work," he said, and kissed her. "Dearest, you must not grieve so. No woman could bring a healthy child to birth under this strain, with a battle impending at any moment. I should have sent you to Camelot, indeed. We are young still, my Guinevere. God may yet send us many children."
But she saw the vulnerable look on his face, and knew he shared her sorrow. She clasped his hand and drew him down beside her on the bench where she sat before the banner.
"Is it not fair?" she said,
and thought she sounded like a child begging for praise.
"It is very beautiful. I thought I had never seen so fine work as this."
And he laid his hand on the crimson-worked scabbard of Excalibur that never left his side.
"But this is finer still.
And I have woven prayers for you and your companions into every stitch," she said in entreaty. "Arthur, listen to me. Do you think, could it not be, God has punished us because he feels we are not fit to give this kingdom another king, you and I, unless we will vow ourselves to serve him faithfully, not in pagan ways, but in the new way under Christ? All the forces of pagan evil are allied against us, and we must fight it with the cross." He laid his hand over hers and said,
"Come, dear love, this is folly. You know I serve God as best I may."
"But you still raise that pagan banner of serpents over your men," she cried. And he shook his head in distress.
"Dear love, I cannot break faith with the Lady of Avalon who set me on my throne."
"It was God and no other who set you on your throne," she said earnestly. "Ah, Arthur, if you love me, do this. If you wish for God to send us another child, do you not see how he has punished us by taking our son to himself?"
"You must not speak so," he said firmly. "To think God would do so is superstitious folly. I came to tell you, at last the Saxons are massing, and we shall move to give them battle at Mount Baden. I would now that you were well enough to ride to Camelot, but it cannot be, not yet."
"Oh, I know it well. I am only an encumbrance to you," she cried out bitterly. "I was never more to you. It is a pity I didn't die with my babe."
"No, no, you must not speak so," he said tenderly. "I have every confidence that with my good sword Excalibur and all my companions we shall triumph. And you must pray for us night and day, my Guinevere."
He rose and added,
"We will not march till daybreak. I will try to come and take leave of you this night before we march, and your father too, and Gawain, and perhaps Lancelot. He sent you greetings, Guinevere. He was very troubled when he heard you were so ill. Can you speak to them if they come?"
She bent her head and said bitterly, "I will do my king and my lord's will. Yes, let them come, though I wonder you trouble to ask my prayers. I cannot even persuade you to put away that pagan banner and raise the cross of Christ. And no doubt God knows your heart, since God will not let you ride forth into battle, believing that any son of yours shall rule this land, because you have not yet resolved to make this a Christian land. He stopped and let her hand go, and she could feel him looking down at her. At last he bent and put his hand under her chin and raised her face to look at his. He said quietly, "My dear lady, my own dear love, in God's name, believe you that?" She nodded, unable to speak, wiping her nose like a child on the sleeve of her gown. "I tell you, dear lady, before God, I believe it not, that God works in such ways, nor that it matters so much what banner we carry. But if it matters thus to you..." He paused and swallowed. "Guinevere, I cannot bear to see you in such distress. If I bear this banner of Christ and the Virgin into battle over my troops, will you cease to mourn and pray to God for me with your best heart?" She looked up at him, transformed, her heart lifting with a wild joy. Would he indeed do this for her? "Oh, Arthur, I have prayed, I have prayed." "Then," said Arthur with a sigh, "I swear it to you, Guinevere, I shall carry only your banner of Christ and the Virgin into battle, and no other sign shall be raised above my legion. So be it. Amen." He kissed her, but Guinevere thought he looked very sad. She clasped his hands and kissed them, and for the first time it seemed that the serpents on his wrists were nothing, mere faded pictures, and that she had indeed been mad to think they could have power to harm her or her child. He called to his squire, who stood at the door of the room, to come and take the banner carefully and to raise it above their camp. "For we march at dawn tomorrow," he said, "and all must see my lady's banner with the Holy Virgin and the cross flying above the legion of Arthur." The squire looked startled. "Sir, my lord, what of the Pendragon banner?" Arthur said, "Take it to the steward and bid him lay it somewhere away. We march under the standard of God." The squire did as Arthur said, and Arthur smiled at Guinevere, but there was little gladness in the smile. "I will come to see you at sunset with your father and some of our kin. We will dine here, and I will have my stewards bring food for us all. Elaine shall not be troubled with providing for so many. Until then, my dear wife." And he went away. In the end, the small dinner was held in one of the little halls, for Guinevere's chamber wouldn't hold so many in comfort. Guinevere and Elaine put on the best gowns which had remained here at Caerleon, and did their hair with ribbons. It was exciting to have some kind of festival after the grim confinement of the last weeks. The feast, though indeed it wasn't much better than army rations, was spread on trestle tables. Most of Arthur's older councillors had been sent to Camelot, including Bishop Patricius, but Taliesin the Merlin had been bidden to dine, and King Lot, and King Uriens of Wales, and Duke Marcus of Cornwall, and Lancelot's older half-brother Lionel of Less Britain, Ban's oldest son and heir. Lancelot was there too, and he found a moment to come to Guinevere's side and kiss her hand, looking into her eyes with hopeless tenderness. "Are you recovered, my lady? I was troubled for you." Under cover of the shadows he kissed her, only a feather brushing of soft lips against her temple. King Leodegrance came too, scowling and fussing, to kiss her brow. "I'm sorry for your illness, my dear, and sorry you lost your child, but Arthur should have bundled you off to Camelot in a litter. That is how I would have handled Eleanor if she had gainsaid me," he scolded. "And now, see, you have gained nothing by staying."
"You must not rebuke her," said Taliesin gently. She has suffered enough, my lord. If Arthur does not reproach her, it is not for her father to do so.
Elaine tactfully changed the subject. Who is yonder Duke Marcus?
He is a cousin of Gawlois of Cornwall, who died before Uther took the throne, said Lancelot. And he has asked Arthur that if we win the day at Mount Baden, he shall have Cornwall by marrying our kinswoman Morgaine.
That old man? Said Guinevere, shocked.
I think it would be as well to give Morgaine to an older man. She has not the kind of beauty to attract a younger one, said Lancelot. But she is clever and learned, and as it happens, Duke Marcus wants her not for himself, but for his son Drustan, who is one of Cornwall's best knights. Arthur has made him one of his companions now, on the eve of this battle. Though it's likely, if Morgaine returns not to court, that Drustan will wed with the daughter of the old Breton King Howel.
He chuckled.
Court gossip of the making of marriages. Is there nothing else to speak of?
Well, said Elaine boldly, when will you tell us of your marriage, Sir Lancelot?
He inclined his head gallantly and said,
On the day when your father offers you to me, Lady Elaine, I will not refuse him. But it is likely your father will have you wed a wealthier man than I. And since my lady here is already wedded...
He bowed to Guinevere, but she saw the sadness in his eyes.
I am in no haste to marry.
Elaine coloured and cast down her eyes. Arthur said,
I bade Pellinor to join us, but he would stay in the field with his men, seeing to the order of march. Some of the wagons are moving out already.
Look, he pointed to the window.
The northern spears blaze over us again.
Lancelot asked, Is Kevin the harper not to be with us?
I bade him come if he would, said Taliesin, but he said he would rather not offend the queen with his presence. Have you quarrelled, Guinevere?
She cast down her eyes and said, I spoke harshly to him while I was ill and in great pain. If you see him, Lord Druid, will you say I would gladly beg his pardon? With Arthur at her side and her banner flying above Arthur's camp, she felt love and charity for everyone, even for the bard.
I think he knows you spoke in the bitterness of your own ordeal, said Taliesin gently.
And Guinevere wondered what the younger Druid had told him.
Abruptly, the door was thrust open, and Lot and Gawain strode into the room.
"'Why, what's this, my lord Arthur?' demanded Lot. "'The Pendragon banner we pledged ourselves to follow. "'It flies no more over the camp, "'and there is great unrest among the tribes. "'Tell me, what have you done?'
Arthur looked pale in the torchlight.
"'No more than this, cousin. "'We are a Christian folk, "'and we fight under the banner of Christ and the Virgin.'
Lot scowled at him.
The archers of Avalon are talking of leaving you, Arthur. Fly your banner of Christ if your conscience so bids you, but raise the Pendragon banner at its side with the serpents of wisdom, or you will see your men scattered, and not all of one heart as they have been through all this dreary waiting. Would you toss all that goodwill away? And the picked folk with their elf bolts have killed many a Saxon before this, and will again. I beg you, don't take away their banner and their allegiance like this.
Arthur smiled uneasily.
Even as that emperor who saw the sign in the sky and said, In this sign shall we conquer, so shall we. You, Urians, who raise the eagles of Rome, you know that tale.
"'I do, my king,' said Uriens. "'But is it wise to deny the folk of Avalon? "'Even as I, my lord Arthur, "'you wear the serpents at your wrists "'in token of a land older than the cross.'
"'But it will be a new land if we win the victory,' said Guinevere. "'And if we do not, it will not matter.'
"'Lot turned as she spoke and looked on her with loathing. "'I might have known this was your doing, my queen.'
Gawain strode restlessly to the window and looked down at the camp.
I see them moving about their fires, the little folk, from Avalon and from your country, King Uriens. Arthur, cousin.
And he went to the king.
I beg of you, as the oldest of your companions, put the Pendragon banner into the field for those who wish to follow it.
Arthur hesitated, but a glance at Guinevere's shining eyes, and he smiled at her and said,
I have sworn it. If we survive the battle, our son shall reign over a land united under the cross. I shall compel no man's conscience, but as it is written in holy writ, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord.
Lancelot drew a deep breath. He stepped away from Guinevere. My lord and king, I remind you, I am Lancelot of the Lake, and I honour the Lady of Avalon. In her name, my king, who was your friend and benefactor, I beg this favour of you. Let me carry the Pendragon banner into battle myself. Then your vow will be kept, and yet you will not be forsworn to Avalon.
Arthur hesitated. Guinevere shook her head imperceptibly, and Lancelot glanced at Taliesin.
Taking the silence for consent, Lancelot was about to stride out of the room when Lot said,
Arthur, no. There is enough talk now about Lancelot being your heir and favourite. If he bears the Pendragon into battle, then will they think you have appointed him to bear your banner, and there will be division in the kingdom. Your party under the cross, and Lancelot's under the Pendragon.
Lancelot turned on Lot violently.
You carry your own banner. So does Leodegrance. So does Uriens. So does Duke Marcus of Cornwall. Why should I not bear a banner of Avalon? But the Pendragon banner is the banner of all Britain, united under one great dragon, said Lot.
And Arthur sighed and nodded.
We must fight under one standard, and that standard is the cross. I'm sorry to refuse you anything, cousin, Arthur said, and reached for Lancelot's hand. But this I may not allow.
Lancelot stood with his mouth taut, visibly holding in his anger, then went to the window.
Lot, behind him, said, I heard it among my Northmen. They say these are the spears of the Saxons which we will face, and the wild swans are crying, and the ravens await us all.
Guinevere stood with her hand tightly clasped in Arthur's. She said quietly, In this sign you shall conquer. And Arthur squeezed her hand.
Though all the forces of hell and not the Saxons alone were ranged against us, lady, with my companions I cannot fail. And you at my side, Lancelot, Arthur said, and moved to draw him close to them both.
A moment Lancelot stood unmoving, his face still set in angry lines. Then he said with a deep sigh,
So be it, King Arthur, but...
He hesitated, and Guinevere, standing very close to him, could feel the shudder which ran through his limbs.
I know not what they will say when they hear of it in Avalon, my lord and my king.
And for a moment there was total silence in the chamber, while the lights, the spears of the flames from the north, flared over them. And then Elaine jerked the curtains shut, closing out the portents, and cried merrily, Come and sit to your dinner, my lords, for if you ride forth to battle at daybreak, you shall not set forth unfeasted, and we have done our best for you. But again and again, as they sat at meat, while Lot and Uriens and Duke Marcus spoke of strategy and troop placement with Arthur, Guinevere caught Lancelot's dark eyes, and they were filled with sorrow and dread. Chapter 13 When Morgaine left Arthur's court at Caerleon, asking leave only to pay a visit to Avalon and her foster-mother, she kept her thoughts on Vivien. That way she needn't think of what had befallen her and Lancelot. Whenever she let her mind wander to it,
It was like being burnt with a hot iron of shame. She had offered herself to him in all honesty, in the old way, and he had wanted nothing of her but childish toyings that made a mockery of her womanhood. She didn't know whether it was at him or herself that she was angered, that he could have so played with her, or that she could have hungered for him. Now and again she regretted her harsh words to him. Why had she flung insults at him? He was as the goddess had made him, no worse and no better. But at other times, while she rode eastward, she felt herself to blame. The old taunt of Guinevere,
"Little and ugly as one of the fairy folk," scalded her mind. Had she had more to give? Had she been beautiful as Guinevere was beautiful? Had she been content with what he had to give? And then her mind would swing the other way again. He had insulted her and the goddess through her. So tormented, she rode through the green country of the hills. And after a time, her thoughts began to turn to what awaited her at Avalon. She had left the Holy Isle unpermitted. She had renounced her state as priestess, leaving behind her even the little sickle knife of her initiation. And in the years since, always she had dressed her hair low on her brow, so that none might see the blue crescent tattooed there. Now, in one of the villages, she bartered away a little gilt ring she had for some of the blue paint the tribeswomen used, and painted the faded mark afresh. "All that has befallen me has come because I forswore the vows I had given the goddess." And then she recalled what Lancelot had said in his despair, that there were neither gods nor goddesses, but these were the shapes mankind gives in terror to what they cannot make into reason. But even if this were true, it wouldn't lessen her guilt. For whether the goddess took the form they thought, or whether the goddess was only another name for the great unknowns of nature, still she had deserted the temple and the way of life and thought to which she was pledged, and she had forsaken the great tides and rhythms of the earth. She had eaten foods forbidden to a priestess, had taken the life of animal or bird or plant without giving thanks to that part of the goddess being sacrificed for her good. She had lived unmindful, had given herself to a man without seeking to know the will of the goddess in her suntides, for mere pleasure and lechery. No, it wasn't to be looked for that she could return and all should be as before. And as she rode through the hills, through ripening harvest and fertilizing rain, she was aware, with greater and greater pain, of how far she had come from the teachings of Vivian and of Avalon. "The difference is deeper than I thought. Even those who till the earth, when they are Christians, come to a way of life which is far from the earth. They say that their God has given them dominion over all growing things and every beast of the field. Whereas we dwellers in hillside and swamp, forest and far field, we know that it is not we who have the dominion over nature, but she who has dominion over us. From the moment lust stirs in the loins of our fathers, and desire in the womb of our mothers to bring us forth under her dominion, to when we quicken in the womb, and are brought forth in her time, to the lives of plant and animal which must be sacrificed to feed and swaddle, and clothe us, and give us strength to live. All of these things are under the domain of the goddess, and without her beneficent mercy, none of us could draw a living breath, but all things would be barren and die. And even when the time comes for barrenness and death, so that others may come to take our place on this earth, that is her doing too. She who is not only the green lady of the fruitful earth, but also the dark lady of the seed lying hidden beneath the snows, of the raven and the hawk who bring death to the slow, and of the worms who work in secret to destroy that which has served its time, even Our Lady of rot and destruction and death at the end. In the memory of all these things,
Morgaine came at last to see that what had happened with Lancelot, after all, was but a little thing. The greatest sin was not with Lancelot, but in her own heart, that she had turned away from the goddess. What did it matter what the priest thought was good, or virtuous, or sinful, or shameful? The wound to her pride was only a healthful cleansing. The goddess will deal with Lancelot in her own time and her way. It is not for me to say. At the moment, Morgaine thought it the best thing that could happen, should she never set eyes again on her cousin. No, it wasn't to be looked for that she could return to her place as chosen priestess. But Vivien might have pity on her, and let her amend her sins against the goddess. At the moment she felt she could be content to dwell in Avalon, even as servant or humble worker-woman in the fields. She felt like a sick child hurrying to lay her head in her mother's lap and weep there. She would send for her son and have him fostered in Avalon among the priests, and never depart again from the way she had been taught. And so, when first she saw the sight of the Tor thrusting itself up, green and unmistakable over the hills lying in between, the tears streamed down her face. She was coming home, home to her own place and to Vivien. She would stand within the ringstones and pray to the goddess that her faults might be healed, that she might return to that place from which her own pride and self-will had thrust her. It seemed that the Tor was playing hide-and-seek with her, now visible, thrusting itself up between the hills like an erect phallus, now hiding between smaller hills, now disappearing in the damp fogs. But at last she came to the shores of the lake where she had come with Vivien so many years ago. The greying waters, in late evening sunlight, lay empty before her. Against the red light in the sky, the reeds were dark and barren, and the shores of the island of the priests just visible, rising in the sunset mist. But nothing stirred, nothing moved on the water, even though she thrust forth her whole heart and mind in a passionate effort to reach the holy isle, to summon the barge. An hour she stood there unmoving, and then the darkness closed down, and she knew she had failed. No, the barge would not come for her, this night or ever again. It would come for a priestess, for Vivien's chosen, cherished fosterling. It wouldn't come for a runaway who had lived in secular courts and done her own will for 4 years. Once before, at the time of her initiation, she had been cast forth from Avalon, and the test of whether or no she might be called priestess was only this, that she should return without aid. She couldn't call the barge. She feared within her very soul to cry aloud the word of power that would summon it through the mists. She could not command it. Who had forfeited the right to be called a child of Avalon? As the colour left the water and the last remnants of the sunlight faded into twilight mist, Morgaine looked mournfully toward the distant shore. No, she dared not call the boat, but there was another way into Avalon, around at the other side of the lake, where she could cross by the hidden path through the swamp, and there find her way into the hidden world. Aching with loneliness, she began to skirt the shore, leading her horse. The looming presence of the big animal in the dusk, his snorting breaths behind her, were a vague comfort. If all failed, she could spend the night on the shores of the lake. It wouldn't be the first night she had spent alone in the open, and in the morning she would find her way. She remembered that solitary journey, disguised, to Lot's court far in the north years ago. She had grown soft with the good living and luxury of the court, but she could do it again if she must. But it was so still. No sound of bells from the Isle of the Priests, no chantings from the convent, no bird cries. It was as if she moved through an enchanted country. Morgaine found the place she was looking for. It was growing dark,
and each bush and tree seemed to take on a sinister shape, some strange thing, some monster, some dragon. But Morgaine was recovering the habits of mind she had possessed when she dwelt in Avalon. There was nothing here that would harm her, if she meant it no harm. She began to take her way along the hidden path. Halfway she must move through the mists. Otherwise the path would but bring her to the monk's kitchen garden behind their cloister. She admonished herself firmly to stop thinking of the growing darkness, and set her mind into meditative silence, fixing it on where she longed to go. Thus, then, with each step as if she wound a spell, treading out the spiral dance as if the way wound up the Tor toward the ringstones, she moved silently, her eyes half closed, placing each foot with care. She could feel the mists cold about her now. Vivian hadn't thought it any great ill that she should lie with her half-brother and bear him a child. A child born of the old royal line of Avalon, more a king than Arthur's self. Had she borne such a child to Lancelot, then could that child have been fostered here in Avalon and reared to become one of the greatest of the druids. Now what would become of her son? Why did she leave Gwydion in the hands of Morgause? Morgaine thought, I am an unnatural mother. I should have sent for my son. But she hadn't been willing to look Arthur in the face and tell him of his child's existence. She wouldn't want the priests and ladies at court to look on her and say, this is the woman who bore a child to the Horned One in the old pagan way of the tribes who paint their faces and wear horns and run with the deer like animals. The boy was well enough where he was. Arthur's court was no place for him. And what would she do with a little boy of three running at her heels? Arthur's. But there were times when she thought of him, remembering nights when he had been brought to her full-fed and sweet-smelling, when she had sat holding him and crooning to him, thinking of nothing, her whole body filled with mindless happiness. When else had she been so happy? Only once, she thought, when Lancelot and I lay in the sunshine on the Tor, when we hunted waterfowl by the shores of the lake. And then, blinking, she realized that by this time she should have come further than this. She should be past the mists and on the solid ground of Avalon. And indeed, the boggy places were gone. There were trees around her, and the path was firm underfoot. And she hadn't come to the priest's kitchen garden and outbuildings either. She should now be in the field behind the house of maidens, leading into the orchard. Now she must think of what she would say when she was found here, of the words she would speak to prove to the folk of Avalon that she had the right to be here. Or did she? Somehow it seemed that it was a little less dark. Perhaps the moon was rising. It was 3 or 4 days after the full. Soon there would be light enough to find her way. It wasn't to be looked for that every tree and bush should be the same as when she had dwelt here, and known every step of the path. Morgaine clung to her horse's bridle, suddenly afraid of losing her way on the once familiar paths. No. It was actually growing brighter. She could see the bushes and trees quite plainly now. If the moon was rising, why couldn't she see it above the trees? Had she somehow gotten turned round while she was walking with her eyes half closed, treading out the path that led through the mists and between the worlds? If only she might see some familiar landmark. There were no clouds now. She could see the sky, and even the mists had gone. But she could make out no star. Perhaps she'd been away too long from such things. She could see no sign of rising moon, though it should have been long since in the sky. And then it was as if cold water flooded down her back and set her blood to moving like ice inside her. That day when she had gone to seek roots and herbs, when she would have cast forth the child within her,
had she wandered again into that enchanted country which was neither the world of Britain nor the secret world where the magic of the Druids had taken Avalon, but that older, darker country where there was neither star nor sun? She bade her beating heart to still itself. She gripped the horse's bridle and leaned against the warm, sweaty flank, feeling the solidity of muscle and bone, hearing the soft, snorting breaths real and definite under her cheek. Surely, if she stood still for a little and took thought, she would find her way. But fear was rising in her. I cannot go back. I cannot go back to Avalon. I am not worthy. I cannot make my way through the mists. On the day of the ordeal of initiation, she had felt this for a moment, but she had firmly put her fear aside. But I was younger then, and innocent. Never then had I betrayed the goddess or the secret teachings. Never had I betrayed life. Morgain fought to control the rising tides of panic. Fear was the worst thing. Fear would put her at the mercy of whatever misfortune came. Even the wild beasts could smell fear on your body and would come and attack, while they would flee from the courageous. This was why the bravest man could run among the deer with safety, so long as fear wasn't smelled on his skin. Was this, she wondered, why they smeared their bodies with the acrid blue dye of woad, because it covered the smell of fear? Perhaps the truly brave man or woman was the one whose mind made no pictures of what might happen if things went awry. There was nothing here to harm her, even if it might be that she had strayed into the fairy country. Once before she had found herself there, but the woman who had mocked her had offered no harm or threat. They were older even than the Druids, but they too lived by the will and rule of the goddess in their life and ways, and it might even be that one could guide her to her proper path. So either way, there was nothing to fear. At worst, she would meet no one and spend a lonely night among the trees. Now she saw a light. Was it one of the lights that burned in the court of the House of Maidens? If it was so, well, then she would soon be home. And if not, then she could ask her way of whatever folk she met. If she had strayed into the Isle of the Priests, then if she met with some strange priest, he might fear that she was one of the fairy women. She wondered if, from time to time, these women did come to tempt the priests. It was only reasonable that here, in the very shrine of the goddess, some priests with more imagination than others might feel the pulse of this place, come to know that his way of life was a denial of the forces of life which ran within the very pulse-beat of the world. They denied life rather than affirming it. From the life of the heart and the life of nature to the life that ran at root between man and woman. If I were Lady of Avalon, on the nights when the moon was new and springing, I would send the maidens into the cloister of the priests to show them that the goddess cannot be mocked or denied, that they are men, and that women are not evil inventions of their pretended devil, but that the goddess will have her way with them. Aye, at Beltane, or Midsummer. Or would these mad priests bid the maidens be gone, and think them demons come to tempt the faithful? And for a moment it seemed she could hear the voice of the Merlin. Let all men be free to serve what god they best like. Even, she wondered, one which denied the very life of the earth? But she knew Taliesin would have said, even so. Now through the trees, she made out clearly the shape of a torch, flaring up yellow and blue from a long pole. The glare of it blinded her eyes for a moment, and then she saw the man who held the torch. He was small and dark, and neither priest nor druid. He wore a loincloth of spotted deerskin, and some sort of dark cloak over his bare shoulders. He was like to one of the little tribesmen, only taller. His hair was dark and long, and he wore a garland of coloured leaves in it. Autumn leaves, though the leaves hadn't yet turned. And somehow that frightened Morgaine. But his voice was mellow and soft as he spoke in an ancient dialect. "Welcome, sister. Are you benighted? Come this way. Let me lead your horse. I know the paths." It was for all the world, she thought, as if she were expected. As if she had fallen into a dream, Morgaine followed. The path grew harder underfoot and easier to follow, and the light of the torch blurred away the misty dimness. He led the horse, but now and then he turned toward her and smiled. Then he reached out and took her by the hand, as if he were leading a young child. His teeth were very white, and his eyes, dark in the torch glow, were merry. There were more lights now. At some point, she didn't know when, he had given over her horse to another, and led her within a ring of lights. She didn't remember coming within walls, but she was in a great hall where there were men and women feasting with garlands on their heads. Some bore garlands of the autumn leaves, but at the same time there were women who bore garlands of early spring flowers, the little pale arbutus that hides under the leaves even before the snow is gone. Somewhere a harp was playing. Her guide was still at her side. He led her toward the high table, and there, somehow without surprise, she recognized the woman she had seen before, wearing in her hair a garland of bare-twined wicker-withes. The woman's grey eyes seemed ageless and knowing, as if she could read and see all things. The man set Morgaine on a bench and put a tankard in her hand. It was of some metal she didn't know. The liquor in it was sweet and smooth, and tasted of peat and heather. She drank thirstily, and realized she had drunk too quickly after her long fast. She felt dizzied. Then she recalled the old tale. Should you blunder into the fairy country, you must never drink nor eat of their food. But that was only an old tale, no more. They wouldn't harm her. She asked, "What is this place?" The lady said, "This is Castle Chariot, and you are welcome here, Morgaine, Queen of Britain." She shook her head. "No, no, I'm no queen. My mother was High Queen, and I am Duchess of Cornwall, but no more." The lady smiled. "It is all one. You are weary and have travelled long. Eat and drink, little sister, and tomorrow one shall guide you wherever you wish to go. Now is the time for feasting." There were fruits on her plate and bread, a dark, soft bread of some unknown grain, but it seemed she had tasted it somewhere before this. She saw that the man who had led her hither had bracelets of gold about his wrists, twining like live snakes, and she rubbed her eyes, wondering if she had fallen into a dream. And when she looked again, it was only a bracelet, or perhaps a tattoo, like the one Arthur bore from his king-making. And at times, when she looked at him, the torches flared so, it seemed that there was a shadow of antlers above his brow. And the lady was crowned and hung about with gold. But now and again it seemed it was only a crown of wicker, and she had a necklace of shells about her throat, the little shells which were halved like a woman's private parts and sacred to the goddess. She sat between them, and somewhere a harp was playing, a sweeter music than even the harps of Avalon. She was no longer wearied. The sweet-tasting drink had cleared her mind of fatigue and sorrow. Later, someone put a harp in her hand, and she too played and sang. Never had her voice sounded so soft and clear and sweet. She fell into a dream as she played, where it seemed all the faces around her wore the semblance of someone she had known elsewhere. It seemed she walked on the shores of a sunny island and played a curious bowed harp.
And then there was a time when she sat in a great stone courtyard, and a wise druid in strange long robes taught them with compasses and a star finder. And there were songs and sounds that would open a locked door or raise a circle of ringstones. And she learned them all, and was crowned with a golden serpent over her brow. The lady said it was time to go to rest. On the morrow one would guide her and her horse. She slept that night in a cool room hung about with leaves. Or were they tapestries that now seemed to twist and change, telling stories of all the things that had been? She saw herself, too, woven into the tapestry with her harp in her hand, with Gwydion on her lap, and she saw herself woven into the tapestry with Lancelot. He played with her hair and held her hand, and she thought there was something she should remember, some reason she should be angry with Lancelot. But she couldn't remember what it was. When the lady said that this night was festival, and she should stay here a day or two more and dance with them, she let it be. It was so long, it seemed, since she had danced and been merry. But when she took thought to what festival it might be, she couldn't quite remember. Surely the equinox had not come yet, nor could she see moon or sun to reckon it for herself as she had been taught. They put a garland of flowers in her hair, bright summer flowers. "For," said the lady, "you are no untried maiden." It was a starless night, and it troubled her that she couldn't see the moon, as she hadn't seen the sun by day. Had it been one day, or two, or three? Somehow time seemed not to matter. She ate when she was hungry, slept where she was when she felt weary, alone, or lying on a bed soft as grass, with one of the lady's maidens. Once, to her surprise, she found the maiden. Yes, she looked somewhat like Raven, twining her arms round her neck and kissing her, and she returned the kisses without surprise or shame. It was as it is in a dream, where strange things seem wholly possible, and she was surprised at this, just a little, but somehow it didn't seem to matter. She lived in an enchanted dream. Sometimes she wondered what had happened to her horse, but when she thought of riding forth, the lady said she mustn't think of it yet. They willed that she should stay with them. Once, years afterward, when she was trying to recall all that had befallen her within the castle chariot, she remembered that she had lain in the lady's lap and suckled at her breast, and it didn't seem strange to her at all that she, a grown woman, should lie in her mother's lap and be kissed and dandled like an infant. But surely that had been no more than a dream when she was dizzied with the sweet-tasting strong wine. And sometimes it seemed to her that the lady was Vivian, and she wondered, "Have I fallen sick? Am I lying in a fever and dreaming all these curious things?" She went out with the lady's maidens and searched with them for root and herb, and the season seemed not to matter. And at the festival, was it that same night or another, she danced to the harps, and again she took a turn at the harps for the dancing, and the music she made sounded both melancholy and merry. Once when she was searching for berries and flowers for garlands, her feet stumbled over something, the white bleached bones of some animal, and round its neck was a fragment of leather, and on that a scrap of red cloth. It was something like to the bag in which she had borne her gear when she rode from Caerleon. What, she wondered, had happened to her own horse? Was it safe in the stables here? She hadn't seen stables at all in the fairy castle, but she supposed they were somewhere. For now it was enough to dance, to sing, to let time pass, enchanted. Once, the man who had brought her there led her aside from the dancing ring. She was never to know his name. How, when she could see neither sun nor moon, could the tides of moon and sun beat in her so fiercely?
"You have a dagger about you," he said. "You must put it from you. I cannot bear it near."
She unfastened the leather thongs that bound it to her waist and cast it away, not knowing where it fell. Then he came to her, his dark hair